We've been looking at these certain conversations that Jesus has with people that then get recorded in the scriptures. And what we've done is we've not focused necessarily on moments that Jesus was teaching crowds or in, you know, these kind of large teaching moments in synagogues or, you know, on hillsides, but rather these conversations and interactions that he has with individuals that we see recorded in the scriptures that at first we may be tempted to just kind of read right by and not stop and pay attention to it. But when we do that, when we're willing to pause and we're willing to stop and reflect on these kind of short interactions, what we discover is that it gives us some further insight into Christ, and it gives us further insight into the kind of life he invites us into. And so this morning, if you have a Bible, I want to invite you to turn to the book of John, chapter 20. And John is in the New Testament. If you don't have a Bible, we'll put the words on the screen behind me. But John's the fourth book in the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. And John is one of the four books that record the life of Jesus. And it's typically thought of John to be the last one written chronologically, authored by John or by some of John's closest followers together with him, kind of really later on in his life. And John was one of these original disciples of Jesus, one of the 12, one of his closest kind of followers. Now, before we get to the conversation I want us to look at today, I want to back up and I want to spend a little bit of time establishing some relational context, because I think it's important for us to understand the conversation that takes place later on. And so what we find here in John chapter 20 is that it is the morning of the third day after Jesus has been crucified on the cross. And this is what we read, John chapter 20, starting with verse 1. So it says, early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the entrance. So she came running to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one Jesus loved. So already, if you pause for a moment after reading that, if you can put yourself in Simon Peter's position for a moment, that kind of feels pretty much like a slap in the face when it says, so she ran to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one Jesus loved. Notice it doesn't say the ones Jesus loved. It says the one Jesus loved. And so if you're Peter, and if you're reading this after it's been written down, you'd likely been like, hey, what was that about? You know, where'd that come from? Now, what makes it even more interesting is that it's pretty clear that as you pay attention to the context of this and other scriptures, that the John is referring to himself as this other disciple that Jesus loved. Now, in this period in history, it was fairly popular for a writer not to name themselves in their own stories, but rather come up with a phrase that they could use to describe themselves. So John, in a spirit of great humility, comes up with the phrase, the one Jesus loved. Yeah, that's me. I'm the one Jesus loved. Now, perhaps that explains why John waited the longest to write his account of Jesus' life. Maybe he was waiting around for everyone else to die. So that, because you can imagine what the other disciples, especially Peter, would what they would have thought reading that for the first time. And been like, whoa, wait a second. You know, what is that? Who do you think you are? But keep going. Notice what he writes. Verse 2. So she came running to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one Jesus loved, and said, they have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we don't know where they have put him. So Peter and the other disciple started for the tomb. Both were running, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. Now, you got to admit, that's just like a guy, you know? Here's John. He's recording the most pivotal moment that we know of in human history, and he wants to make sure that it's clear to everyone who's going to read this later on who's the faster runner between him and Peter. So he wants to make sure that gets in there. Verse 5. He bent over, looked in at the strips of linen lying there, but did not go in. Then Simon Peter, who was behind him, just in case anyone forgot, just want to make that clear, arrived and went into the tomb. He saw the strips of linen lying there, as well as the burial cloth that had been around Jesus' head. The cloth was folded up by itself, separate from the linen. Finally, the other disciple, who had reached the tomb first, just so you're clear, everybody's got that, also went inside. He saw and believed. So John's kind of like at the end, you know what? I walked into the tomb and believed right away. That's just kind of the faith that I have. But Peter, of course, you know, he couldn't put it together as quickly as I could because, you know, he's kind of slow and that's just kind of what happens. And so here's this very interesting thing that we find woven into the most incredible news ever that Jesus is resurrected from the dead, that the tomb is empty. And here in the midst of that story, in the midst of that account, is this hint, and really not a hint, but a pretty clear indication that there's some kind of strange rivalry going on between Peter and John, at least on John's end. So who does Jesus love more? Who runs faster? Who has more faith? There's this weird rivalry thing going on. Now, you got to take that context and move it forward with you into the next chapter, chapter 21, where we find the resurrected Jesus, and he's appearing to his disciples and this core group of followers, and they end up having breakfast on the shore of the Sea of Galilee. And while he gathers the disciples together on the shore, Jesus has this conversation with Peter that I want us to look at. Now, this is the same Peter who, before the resurrection, he's denied Jesus three times, which, not surprisingly, John makes sure to include in his gospel account of Peter denying Jesus three times. But three different times, what happens before Jesus is crucified, and as he's being crucified, three different people come up to Peter and say, hey, aren't you one of this Jesus' followers? And he's like, I don't know what you're talking about. And they're like, no. Aren't you one of them? Don't you know him? Aren't you one of his guys? And Peter keeps insisting three different times, I don't know what you're talking about. That's not me. I don't even know who he is. And he denies Jesus. He denies even knowing him three different times. And so Jesus and Peter end up having this conversation on the shore. And it's really probably the first time that they've talked since that moment, since that went down. They have this conversation. Verse 15 says, when they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John. Now, he's talking about a different John there. Don't get confused there. John's a pretty common name then and now. Simon, son of John, do you truly love me more than these? Now, hit the pause button there for a second, because when he says, do you love me more than these, we're really not quite sure what he's talking about. Either maybe it's he looks around at the other disciples, the other followers that are gathered there, and he's saying, you know, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these people? Do you love me more than these other guys? Or what we also read in the context is that they had just pulled up a huge net full of fish. Peter had spent his whole life being a fisherman. And so what we don't know is maybe Jesus is pointing to a group of fish that have been pulled up on the shore. And maybe he's asking the question, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? Do you love me more than these fish here of your whole career, your job? But regardless of which one it is, Peter replies this way. He says, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Jesus said, feed my lambs. And so essentially what he's saying with that word picture to Peter is, Peter, here's what I want you to do. I want you to take care of my followers. I want you to shepherd them. I want you to pastor them. This is this role. This is what I have for you moving forward. This is the job that I want to entrust to you. Verse 16, again, Jesus said, Simon, son of John, do you truly love me? He answered, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Jesus said, take care of my sheep. The third time he said to him, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him the third time, do you love me? He said, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. Jesus said, feed my sheep. Now, some people, you know, kind of have all different thoughts and ideas of why Jesus asked him the same question three times. But some people conclude, and I'd probably lean more toward this, is that it was just kind of this metaphorical way of Jesus responding to and communicating redemption for the three times that Peter had denied him just 3 days earlier. That Peter denied him three separate times. And so here he is asking him this question three different times. Do you love me? Are you with me? Verse 18 says, I tell you the truth, when you were younger... This is Jesus speaking to Peter. When you were younger, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands. Someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go. Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. Now, Peter's death isn't recorded in the scriptures, but early church tradition teaches and have kind of passed down through the ages that Peter ended up being crucified, that he was stretched out his hands, led to some place he didn't want to go, just kind of as Jesus kind of, you know, had prophesied over his life. To end up being crucified by the Roman Emperor Nero in the middle of the first century. Then he said to him, verse 19, follow me, follow me. Peter turned and saw the disciple whom Jesus loved was following them. This was the one who had leaned back against Jesus at the supper and had said, "Lord, who's going to betray you?" And when Peter saw him, he asked, "Lord, what about him?" Jesus answered, "If I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? You must follow me." Because of this, the rumor spread among the brothers that this disciple would not die. But Jesus did not say that he would not die. He only said, if I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? You see, people back then, occasionally, they would take Jesus' words out of context and they would twist them around to mean something that Jesus actually didn't mean. So thankfully, that only happened back then. Really glad that doesn't happen today anymore. But here's what I want us to notice. Jesus looks at Peter, and he lays out this sacred vision for his life, to shepherd and care for his followers, to pastor the church, essentially, as it moves forward. He's entrusting him with this sacred responsibility, and Jesus looks at him and says, "Follow me." And Peter's response to him at that moment was to look back at John and say, "Lord, what about him? What's his job going to be? What's his calling going to be? Because God, I'm not even sure really how to feel about what you just told me until I know what he's got. Until I know what you have for him." Jesus responds and he says, "What is that to you? You must follow me. You. You must follow me." So how many times do you and I find ourselves looking around at what Jesus has invited us to do, the responsibilities that Jesus has entrusted us with, and we find ourselves distracted looking around and comparing ourselves to others and being like, yeah, but what about him? What about her? What about them? Because Jesus, I don't even really know how to feel about what you're asking me to do until I know what you have for them. And very often, that distraction that we wrestle with is rooted in not being okay with what God has entrusted us with. The life he has invited us in. And more specifically, it's rooted in many times us not being okay with how God has made us. That we wish we were taller. We wish we were thinner. We wish we drove his car, had their money. Wish we had her body, their house. We wish we were born into their family or had their purity, had their lack of baggage, had their talents, had their abilities, had their opportunities. And in the process of looking around at what everyone else has, we can find ourselves unable to be at peace with ourselves. Where Jesus keeps inviting us to live our life, to embrace our invitation, our specific calling, and we keep going, yeah, but what about her? What about him? Because I don't even know how to feel about what you've given me, what I look like, who I am, until I figure out what you have for them. Now, one of the things to keep in mind is this isn't true for individuals, this is true for groups, for communities, for companies, for schools, for organizations. It's true for churches. It's true for families, where people many times find themselves looking around, being distracted by other groups, distracted by other organizations, companies, churches. And there's always this mindset, well, you know what? If we only had their teachers, if we only had their facilities, if only we had their budget, if only we had their connections or their products, their apps, then, you know what? If we had their website, then we'd be much better off. You see this play out all the time. See it happen in the scriptures. Look at 1 Samuel chapter 8. It's exactly what we find happening with the people of Israel, the nation of Israel. And so chapter 8, verse 4, it says, "So all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel." Samuel was this prophet that helped guide the people and helped kind of shepherd and pastor the people there. It came to Samuel at Ramah. And they said to him, "You are old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have." But when they said, "Give us a king to lead us," this displeased Samuel. So he prayed to the Lord. Now, here's the reason why it displeased him. It was because from the very beginning, the intent in God's intent for the people of Israel was that God would rule over this nation. That this group of people would be distinct from all the other people because they would let God be their king. They would let God be the one who would lead them and guide them and reign over them. That Israel would be different from all the other nations because God would be their leader. But here's the people of Israel saying, no, no, no. You know what? We don't want that anymore. What we want is for you to appoint a king to lead us. We want to be like everybody else. We want to be like all the other nations. So look what happens. Verse 7. So the Lord told him, listen to all the people are saying to you. It is not you they have rejected, Samuel. They have rejected me as their king. As they have done from the day I brought them up out of Egypt until this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they are doing to you. Now listen to them, but warn them solemnly and let them know what the king who will reign over them will do. Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking him for a king. Verse 11, he said, this is what the king who will reign over you will do. He will take your sons and make them serve with his chariots and horses, and they will run in front of his chariots. Some he will assign to be commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and others to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and still others to make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive groves and give them to his attendants. He will take a tenth of your grain and of your vintage and give it to his officials and attendants. Your men servants and maid servants and the best of your cattle and donkeys, he will take for his own use. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his slaves. And when that day comes, you will cry out for relief from the king you have chosen, and the Lord will not answer you in that day. But the people refused to listen to Samuel. No, they said, we want a king over us. Then we will be like all the other nations, with a king to lead us and to go out before us and fight our battles. When Samuel heard all that the people had said, he repeated it before the Lord. And the Lord answered, listen to them and give them a king. So God says, you know what? If this is what you want, understand, if this is what you want, this is what's going to happen. This is how the story plays out. This is how that movie goes. If you aren't true to who I've created you to be, if you're unwilling to trust me and follow me, this is what's going to happen. This is going to be the natural result of the consequences that you are choosing. And understand, God isn't saying this out of a spirit of punishment. It wasn't, you know what, if you don't do what I say, then I'm going to make you pay for that. I'm going to punish you out of some kind of spite or revenge. God is saying, listen, I'm trying to lead you into life. I know people. I know how things work. I know where these choices go. I know how this movie plays out. If you choose not to trust me, if you choose not to trust me, to let me lead you into life, this is what will transpire. This will be your downfall. This is how it goes. This is how it always goes. And as you read through the Old Testament, as you read through other historical accounts of this period in history, what God said would happen, happened. Over time, the kingdom of Israel became divided. The king increased the amount of taxes that the people had and created such a burden on them. And he took from them their flocks and he took from them their people and he made them slaves. And eventually the nation split apart and the people went into exile and they got conquered by enemies and carried off to foreign lands. We looked at some of that story last week of what had happened and the suffering that they endured. And you can trace the beginning of the fall of the empire all the way back to a people who were unwilling to live the life that God invited them to uniquely live. Unwilling to embrace what God had uniquely entrusted them with, and instead kept insisting, no, you know, we want what they have. We don't want to be like us. We want to be like them. And understand, they ended up getting exactly what they wanted, and it made them miserable. They got exactly what they kept insisting for, and it made them miserable. Elsewhere in the Old Testament, we find this in the book of Job. It says, resentment kills a fool and envy slays the simple. That author, he's basically saying the same thing in two different ways. That Hebrew word that gets translated as into English is simple. Many times we have some, you know, today we don't think of simple this way as much. But it carries this idea in the Hebrew of this idea of one who is easily deceived. one who doesn't take the time to actually reflect on the way things are. So he's basically saying the same thing twice, that resentment kills a fool, envy slays the fool. That's what a definition of a fool would be. And that's what happens with resentment and envy. They may not literally kill someone, but they very often kill one's joy. They kill one's peace, one's contentment, one's hope, one's ability to enjoy life. And so how do you battle that? And how do you fight against that in your own soul? Because here's the deal. You can't stop being aware of what other people have. You just can't. You can't make that go away. You're going to see other people. You're going to see their talents, their looks, their bodies. You're going to step into other people's homes and you're going to see their bigger and better TV. You're going to see their 10-foot ceilings compared to your 8.5-foot ceilings. You're going to hear stories about other people's kids and their grades and their higher SAT scores than your kids got. And you're going to hear stories of spouses who got things for their spouse that you didn't get yours. And that you're going to hear about parents who gave them more things, more opportunities than yours did. And again, you got to understand, that's always going to be the case. It's always going to be the case. It used to be maybe 150, 200 years ago that you maybe only knew about the people within a couple mile radius of your home. But now, with the flood of streaming information that we have constantly, that we have access to in our own pockets on our phones, we have a tremendous awareness of people and what they have and what they have achieved across the entire globe. So you gotta understand, there is no way to escape being aware of others. There's just really no way around it. But the trick is, you've got to start to become aware of, while you're aware of not rating yourself against them. That's what you have to figure out how to do in your heart. Because you can't stop being aware. But what has to end is the competition. What has to end is the rating system and the comparison that we find ourselves caught up in all the time. And the key way to start doing that is you have to increase the level of awareness in yourself. Because if you don't, that building resentment, that building envy will destroy you. It will destroy your joy. It will destroy your peace. And you will be miserable. And so with the rest of our time today, what I want to do is I just want to spend some time and I want to ask you some questions that help in that process. Questions that I think are good for all of us to wrestle through. And they're questions not original with me. These questions have been around for a long time. But I think there's questions, these are questions that are good for us to all kind of sit with, to kind of soak on, to come back to on a regular basis, to help us battle this thing that's really in all of us. So here we go. One, who are you looking around at to think, am I okay? Who is that for you? Who do you find yourself looking around at to evaluate whether or not you're okay? Because as long as you keep looking around and saying, you know what? Well, what about him? What about her? What about them? You'll never feel like you're okay no matter what you achieve, no matter what you attain, no matter what you look like. So who are you looking at? Is it your boss? Is it a coworker? Is it another parent? Another spouse? Are you looking at some guy or some girl that you're desperately trying to get to like you? A sibling? Some random person in a bathing suit at the pool? Who are you looking at? Who are you looking at trying to figure out if you're okay? If you measure up? Who are you looking at trying to figure out if you're okay? And you need to be aware of that. You need to pay attention to that because, understand, it is killing some of you. That constant looking around, trying to figure out if you're okay, it's killing you. And you need to hear Jesus say, wait. What is that to you? You be you. You follow me. Another question. Are you allowing what others have to keep you from enjoying what you have? Are you allowing what others have to keep you from enjoying what you have? Now, ironically, I was sitting on my back porch last night and I was sketching these questions out in a notebook. And I got distracted for a minute after I wrote this one down. Literally, the time I wrote that one down, got distracted. And when I came back, before I kind of got back into sketching some stuff out, I checked Twitter. And on Twitter, there was this link to this marriage proposal. And some guy, maybe you've seen it in the last couple of days, some guy just went all out. I mean, it's on YouTube, and he had like 60 plus family and friends coordinating this whole synchronized lip dub. You know, they're going down the street, and all these people start popping out of nowhere, and they're singing this song. And he's got his girlfriend on the back of a, you know, car with the trunk open, and she's just sitting there, and they're slowly going down. And you see all this thing transpire. And there's people tweeting, and they're just like, man, this guy puts all of us to shame. Here you go, you know, all this kind of stuff. And so... And my first thought after watching it, and it was great, and it was impressive. My first thought was, you know what? Man, I should have given my wife a more memorable proposal than I did. And I'm sitting there, and I looked back at my paper, what I'm writing down. And I'm like, wait a second. You know what? I just did exactly what I'm talking about. That all of a sudden, I'm allowing someone else's proposal moment to affect how I think about my own. And even the person that tweeted it and how they thought about it, this guy puts us to shame. The implication in that is all of the rest of us should feel shame for what we've done based on this guy. This is the standard. And it's a very subtle way of communicating that. And he didn't mean that by harm, but that's what's getting communicated. And rather to stop in that moment and be like, you know what? No, I love the proposal moment that my wife and I shared. You know, that's our moment and I'm grateful for that. And at the same time, I need to be grateful for his. I can celebrate that and say, great job. That's awesome. And not have to figure, wait, why am I rating? Why am I comparing? Why am all of a sudden, now I don't enjoy mine as much because I've seen his. What is that in me? So we got to wrestle with that. Are you allowing what others have to keep you from enjoying what you have? Maybe you loved your house till you walked in one with a finished basement. Or you walked into one with a bigger backyard and then suddenly you didn't like yours as much. Maybe your car was great until you sat in one with those deep, huge cup holders that fit the Roo cup just right. And now you just feel like you kind of have to tolerate your car. No, or maybe you were very content and grateful for your salary till you found out what another coworker made. Or you loved your job, or you were okay with staying home. Until you went back to a high school reunion and listened to what you considered to be more successful stories than yours. Or maybe you were content with being single and where God had you until suddenly it seemed like all your friends had boyfriends and girlfriends. And suddenly then you weren't content anymore. So we got to wrestle with that. Are you allowing, are we allowing what others have to keep us from enjoying what we have? Got to ask that. Another question. Do you find yourself enjoying your kids, or are you driving them based on what other kids are accomplishing? Do you find yourself enjoying your kids, or are you driving them based on what other kids are accomplishing? Some of you, you found yourself enjoying your kid when he or she was 12 months old and was crawling around and crawling around all over the place. But then you went to a playgroup. And there was a 10-month-old crawling around. And then they just stopped crawling and suddenly they started walking. And you suddenly shifted into, whoa, wait a second, my kid doesn't walk. What's wrong with my kid? That kid's 2 months younger than my kid. What's wrong with me as a parent? What am I doing wrong? What's wrong with me? And suddenly you found it more difficult to enjoy your child where he or she was at the moment. And it became about, hey, you go home and I got to help my kid start to learn to walk. And how do I get my kid to measure up to this kid or these other kids? And you got to understand, that mentality can become a pattern that continues their entire lives. And some of you, you understand that all too well. Some of you today have fractured and distant relationships with your own parents because you felt like it was always about your performance in your home growing up. That being you wasn't ever good enough. And it always felt like, you know what, if you could only be more like so-and-so, if you could only be more like this kid, this sibling. So do you find yourself enjoying your kids, or are you driving them based on what other kids are accomplishing? Because there's a lot at stake, not only for your own relationship with your kid, But you also have to understand there's a lot at stake in how they view God, because don't think that that mindset does not translate into how that they think God thinks about them. That they think that God rates them based on their performance, and that God's love for them is conditional on their performance. Kids will get their understanding from God on how we treat them and shepherd them and care for them. Another question. Some of you are like, don't ask any more questions. Is it possible that your husband or wife feels like you're disappointed in them because you keep comparing them with other husbands and wives? Is it possible that your husband or wife feels like you're disappointed in them because you keep comparing them with other husbands and wives? Maybe it's very blatant. Why can't you just be more like this person? But maybe for you, it's more subtle. Maybe it's a bit more manipulative, where you find yourself intentionally sharing stories about, you know, what house projects your friend's spouse is working on, or the kind of meals your friend's spouse keeps making, or what kind of vacations your friend's spouse arranges and spends money on. And your hope in intentionally sharing those kind of stories, really your motivation in that, is trying to motivate your own spouse to do the same. And in your mind, you may think that you're motivating them, but in reality, what you're actually doing is fueling a crippling sense of disappointment. Or what do you think? What do you think it does to your husband when you find yourself obsessed with these fantasy guys in some kind of trashy romance novel, and you get obsessed with certain guys? What do you think it does, whether you ever say it or not, in terms of how your husband feels like he ranks in comparison? Because all of us would know there's some ranking system going on, some comparison system going on. Or what about your wife? How do you think your wife feels when you won't stop looking at other women on the internet? How do you think that makes her feel? What do you think that communicates to her, whether you communicate it to her or not? The very act of doing that, what do you think that that is communicating to her heart? What is it that you're fueling in her? Last question. Who would you secretly enjoy seeing fail? If you heard that their business took a major financial hit, if you heard that their business lost some major client, if the next time you saw this particular person, they'd suddenly gained 50 pounds, if you heard about someone's marriage struggling or kids getting into trouble, who is it? Who is it in your life that you would find yourself secretly celebrating when that happens? Because you know what? That's in all of us. It really is. We're not proud of it, but it's there. And if we don't pay attention to it and we let it grow inside of it, us, it becomes toxic. It becomes very toxic. So who is it that if they failed in some way, you would secretly find yourself celebrating? You need to pay attention to that. You need to pay attention to that thing inside of you, because it'll make you miserable, because it ripples out into so many other areas of your life, in the way that you see yourself and the way you see other people. So here's what I want to leave you with today. We'll get out probably a few minutes early, just to let you know. And it's fine. No one ever complains about getting out of church early. But I encourage you to be sensitive with your kids if they're in their small groups, especially if you've got kids that have small groups. I want to make sure that they get to finish up that time, because that's pretty important. But here's what I want to leave you with today. My hope is that we'd be the kind of people who refuse to get caught up in the constant sense of competition and comparison. We'd be the kind of people that learn how to celebrate others, and that we would discipline ourselves to celebrate other people, both privately and publicly. And we'd wage war against that constant impulse to let envy take root whenever something good happens to someone else. That when we hear someone else's story, when something good happens with someone else and they're sharing that with us, rather than trying to figure out where do we rate, and how do we compare, and how do we share our story, and how does that make us feel about our own story, that we would find ways to celebrate that, disciplining our hearts to celebrate that, and to even do so publicly. Some people are like, well, it wouldn't feel honest if I celebrated them publicly. No, public celebration is a way that you discipline yourself to uproot the envy that takes root in us. Got to learn to do that, because you got to lead yourself in learning how to celebrate other people, so this constant rating system we can let go of. Two, is that I'm hoping and praying that we'll be the kind of people who realize how critical gratefulness is to our enjoyment of life. That we'd realize that gratefulness and contentment are intrinsically linked together. And that we'd learn how to be grateful for who God has made us to be and what he's entrusted us with. And we'd be the kind of people that would discipline our minds to focus on things that we have to be grateful for, even in the midst of difficult circumstances, even when things are really, really hard. That we would say, I can't lose sight of all the things that I have to be grateful for in this moment. And three, that when we have this junk in us, because all of us do, that we'd be the kind of people who are courageous enough to bring it to light. We'd be courageous enough to go to someone and to say, you know what? I've had this resentment growing up in me for a long period of time. I've had this immature longing to have what you have or to be who you are. And it's created this distance between you and I and has been eating away at me. That if you want freedom from that, and I'm not talking about getting on a stage and announcing it to everybody, but to the people it's affected in a close circle of people, that you would state it out loud. You would break that bond that it has on you, these shackles that it has on you to keep you from being free, and that you'd share that. And then lastly, we'd just be the kind of people who would follow where Christ leads. That we'd hear him say, you know what? You be you. You know what? With your past, with your shortcomings, with your insecurities, with your fears, you be you and you follow me. And when we're tempted to think, yeah, but what about him? What about her? What about them? We'd hear the voice of Christ say to us, what is that to you? You follow me. And we'd have the courage to actually do it. Father, thank you for today. Thank you for this group of people who link arms together to walk and to take this journey together to help figure out the life that you've invited us into. Give us the courage to trust you and to follow you. God, keep us from the temptation to view you as one who rates us based on our performance. And maybe we just trust your love for us, and would we walk in that grace and in that freedom. We love you and thank you in Christ's name. Amen. Thanks, friends. We'll see you next week.